I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. The fight over the budget in Harrisburg is in its 65th day. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf's $31.6 billion budget proposal was rejected by the Republican-controlled legislature earlier this summer. He vetoed their $30.2 billion budget proposal on June 30th. At issue are some deep philosophical and fiscal disagreements over funding for schools, a severance tax on natural gas drilling, changes to the public pension system, and the government control over liquor sales. Meanwhile, programs and people depending on funding are starting to tighten their belts and are worrying about paying their bills. It's our topic this hour of Radio Times. And joining us by telephone is Elizabeth Stell. She's Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation, and that's a free market think tank. Elizabeth Stell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, and with us, I should say, here in our Philadelphia studio is Stephen Herzenberg. He's an economist and executive director of the Keystone Research Center. And Stephen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
Let me start with you, Stephen, just to say that the state has been here before under Governor Rendell. In fact, I think it went into the fall before there was some kind of budget agreement. Are we at a crisis level yet?
Clearly, the budget stalemate is a problem. It's at risk, as we noted in a report that we released yesterday, the state of Working Pennsylvania. The delay in the budget is jeopardizing a recovery that is finally gaining a little speed in Pennsylvania. And as you said, you know, school districts and other service providers are going to start to feel some pain. So I don't think it's a crisis yet. I mean, school districts, many of them have reserve funds and there are ways that people can manage for a period of time, but we need a budget. From our point of view, Governor Wolf proposed a terrific budget in early March, a responsible budget that would strengthen the state's recovery, reinvest in education, partly using funds from a severance tax. It's aligned with what voters want. And from our perspective, the Republicans in the legislature really haven't given an inch yet. I mean, right before the June 30th constitutional deadline for the budget, they passed a budget that was basically last year's budget with a few tiny changes, the fifth Corbett budget. They want to stay a course that's not working. We think the onus is mostly on them to start coming part way so that we can get a compromise that benefits Pennsylvanians.
And I want to pick up on several things that you just said there. To you, Elizabeth Stell, at what point do you think this really does become a crisis for the Commonwealth?
Well, I think people are already hurting. It's very clear that human services providers, school districts, all types of people who depend on their funding from the state are having to make some serious changes right now. And there's really no reason to have this pain. We think that there's every reason to do some sort of stopgap budget. The governor and the legislature agree on 274 of the 400 line items in the budget. So why not pass those, get them funded, and then get to work on the areas where there is disagreement, because very soon the pain is going to get much worse for people. And in terms of it being a responsible budget, you know, the governor proposed a budget that's going to cost a family of four another $1,400 every year. We don't see that as very responsible, and we see that there's much better ways to serve the families and people in Pennsylvania than to raise their taxes.
You shook your head, Stephen. No? The Wolf budget?
Yeah, I mean, the Wolf budget is the first fiscally responsible budget the state has seen since in the last 5 years. It does increase some revenues because the state has a giant structural deficit inherited from the Corbett administration. So most states started reinvesting in education and other programs earlier in the recovery. We didn't, which is why our recovery was so slow. We had these 33,000 jobs lost in public education, which sapped our recovery, took us to the bottom of the economic growth ranking. So the fact is that Governor Wolf's budget really is responsible. If you look over time, the problem that Pennsylvanians face is not that state taxes keep growing. the state taxes are basically 6% of personal income in the state and have been since 1977. They fluctuate a little bit year to year. They're very close to the national average. The real, actually broad issue that families suffer with is the rise of inequality. Because of that, $50 billion a year is transferred from the 99% in Pennsylvania to the top 1%. That's more than one and a half times the size of the total state budget. So if you want to look at the real pressures on working families, it's not taxes, it's inequality. Having said that, then again, Governor Wolf addresses the budget failure, the unbalanced nature of the budget, the cuts-only approach that was in place for the last 4 years. That's why he has to increase revenues to some degree, and it's the right thing to do, and it's what voters support.
Well, let me pick up on one of the – it's really a centerpiece of Governor Wolf's proposal. I'll put this to you, Elizabeth, and he does want to institute a severance tax on natural gas extraction or drilling here in the state of Pennsylvania. Apparently, Pennsylvania is the second producer of natural gas. We do not have a severance tax. There is an impact fee that is paid, or an impact tax, I should say. Why not a severance tax?
Well, I think we have to put into context here what a severance tax would provide in terms of where Governor Wolf wants to increase spending. It's actually a very small part of his overall plan, and he would garner much more from taxes on things like daycare and diapers than he would from a severance tax. That being said, when you look at Pennsylvania and you look at the tax on drillers, you have to consider the entire tax impact. And when you compare us to Texas or Alaska or other states that are large producers of natural gas and oil, you find that our tax burden is already much higher. And so we're already placing a heavier burden on these individuals. And also keep in mind that a severance tax has a significant impact on Pennsylvanians. You're talking about placing more costs and burdens on industry that's already conducting a lot of layoffs. People are already losing their jobs. You're going to just make that worse. You're going to hurt real Pennsylvania families if you go through with a severance tax. And so we think, you know, there are much better ways to address the issues in Pennsylvania than to continue the tax and spend policies that have historically landed us towards the bottom in job creation and income growth.
And again, I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Stephen. And a year ago, when Governor Wolf was running for governor, he talked about a severance tax. Again, this is really a centerpiece of his campaign. Thinking a year ago, looking at prices, fossil fuel prices, thinking that he would get a fair amount of money off a severance tax. As we know, those prices have gone down, had to scale back on some of that money.
Yeah, but you don't want to make the decision about the severance tax based on the revenue when gas prices are at the lowest they've been in a long time. All of the industry projections are they're going to go back up. So you want to make this decision based on, is it a good policy idea? And it turns out that Governor Wolf is right, and most of the people, particularly in this region of the state, where the support for severance tax is strongest, are right.
And there's not a lot of drilling around here.
There's not a lot of drilling. Again, Elizabeth says Pennsylvanians suffer from a severance tax, not according to the Conservative Tax Foundation. When they compare the tax levels across states, they build into their models that severance taxes are actually paid by consumers that purchase the oil or gas in other states. So right now we're paying a severance tax when we get Alaskan oil or gas from other states, and we're not getting the revenue from a severance tax when that's consumed in other states. So that's crazy. We're leaving money on the table. When Elizabeth talks about the taxes that companies pay, she's with all due respect, wrong. Some of the biggest gas companies.
I'll give you a chance, Elizabeth. No, go ahead.
The second biggest gas company paid no corporate income tax in the most recent year available in Pennsylvania. Some of the fact that big oil and gas companies don't pay a lot of taxes generally are because we have this Swiss cheese loophole-ridden corporate tax system, which Governor Wolf is also trying to address while lowering corporate tax rates. So, again, it's easy to get into the weeds on this issue, but mm-hmm. I think the people in your audience in this region should trust their gut. They're on the right target. they're on the right path. Pennsylvania is the outlier. Every other state with significant gas resources has one of these severance taxes. We should too. It is partly a question of children versus drillers.
Because the money, as you know, Elizabeth, and to our listeners, the money the governor wants from this severance tax would go to help pay for public education and I think some higher education in Pennsylvania as well. One of the arguments is that these because of Marcellus Shale, these drillers, they're not going to go anywhere else because this is where the natural gas is. Elizabeth, are they really that burdened?
Yeah, so again, you have to look at the entire picture here. And if you look at just what our impact fee costs them right now, we have the equivalent of roughly 4.7% severance tax right now. If you add on the governor's, you're talking a 17% severance tax, which is way higher than any other natural gas producing state. But, you know, I don't think this issue is really about, you know, burden on the drillers necessarily. It's about what's best for the economy and what's best for individuals. And when you look at numbers by the Independent Fiscal Office, they point out that low and middle income families of Pennsylvania, those earning less than $100,000, are going to pay $180 million in more in utility bills if the severance tax proposal goes through. So you are harming regular average Pennsylvanians with the severance tax, even if you're not paying the full brunt of it. And I just think that's the wrong way to go. And since it's such a small part of the governor's overall proposal anyway, why even move through with it? Again, this is just, you know, you have to ask, why should we punish an industry that's just happening to do well? That's a new industry in Pennsylvania that we haven't taxed before. Why don't we tax, you know, all the other extraction industries if this is such a good idea? I don't think we should go searching for revenue. Rather, I think we need to look at what are the cost drivers of the budget. Where else can we do more with less? Where else can we find the money for education or whatever we want to spend more money on before we go to the taxpayers, before we go taking more out of the economy?
Yeah, fair enough. About a minute. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, so I think Elizabeth's right on target in terms of the issue is what's good for Pennsylvania families and for the state as a whole. Again, I think our perspective on a severance tax is we still have we don't have a severance tax because of the influence of the drilling companies and the Marcellus Shale Coalition, which, big surprise, Governor Corbett's energy czar, Patrick Henderson, now works for the Marcellus Shale Coalition. So, we think that, unfortunately, the drillers now have the policy, the best policy that money can buy. And it's not a policy that's in the best interest of all Pennsylvanians. And long-term, the severance tax will be a significant, not an enormous, but a significant contributor to revenue. We need that. I mean, those companies depend on infrastructure, depend on an educated population. And in case you've forgotten, the last extractive industries we had, coal being the most pronounced example, left everybody, the public, with this giant environmental bill on the back end. And that's still a possibility with gas drilling. There are lots of earthquakes, for example, in Colorado. So again, bottom line, the severance tax policy that serves Pennsylvania would be to do what other states do.
And we are talking about finding some common ground on the Pennsylvania budget. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. It's also day 65 of the budget stalemate. Our guests are Stephen Herzenberg and Elizabeth Stell. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And in this week's edition of the show, it's day 65 of the budget stalemate in Harrisburg. The Republican-led legislature and Democratic Governor Tom Wolf have been unable to agree on a state budget that's led to some slashes in funding, certainly a lot of worries about funding, some political battles as well, and a general sense of unease. And our guests are Elizabeth Stell. She's director of policy analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation. That's a free market think tank. Joining us by telephone and here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Stephen Herzenberg. He's an economist and executive director of the Keystone Research Center. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also have some tweets coming in at WHYY Radio Times, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Elizabeth, you mentioned something earlier, which is, if not the severance tax, do you agree that there needs to be more money invested in education in the state?
Well, you know, we are looking at the education budget, and no matter which budget you're talking about, the governor's or the one passed by the legislature, education spending is at an all-time high. It surpassed what we spent last year. And I think it's time that we really ask, how are we spending those funds rather than do we just need more dollars for our scholars? Pennsylvania continuously ranks very high in terms of how much on the whole we spend per student in education, and we're not really seeing any increases in terms of test results or academic achievement. So I think we need to take a really close look and see how are we spending those dollars and can we put them to use more efficiently to better help our kids rather than just continue to increase the spending budget every year without ever asking, is this money actually making a difference?
Is that an important question, Stephen? To know what we're getting, I guess, for our public dollars for education?
What am I going to say, no to that? No, of course we should use our education dollars wisely, absolutely. But, I mean, the fact is, the very deep cuts, nearly $1 billion in education cuts in 2011 in the first Corbett budget, money that's not yet been restored, money that, cuts that were targeted, particularly at low-income districts, 37% of those cuts were the Philadelphia School District. There's been lots of annual studies by the Pennsylvania Association of State Business Officials looking at the impact on class size, on full-day kindergarten, on AP programs, on arts programs. So it's documented, very well documented, that those deep cuts translated tangibly into lower quality education. The reason Pennsylvania ranks relatively high on average education spending is not because the state puts in enough, which it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's because there are certain very affluent areas in the state, particularly, for example, outside Philadelphia, Radnor, sure. Lower Marion, where folks have a lot of money and are happy to tax themselves quite heavily because they really want to put a lot of money into their schools. But so averages are meaningless. The average of an 8-foot person and a 4-foot person is 2 6-foot people. But unfortunately, many of our low-income school districts are only 4-foot. They're not getting enough money, and the education quality has cut. Test scores have gone down in Pennsylvania because of those cuts, particularly in the districts that took the deepest cuts, the urban areas with concentrated poverty. The Corbett administration tried to bury those numbers, but they've been extracted, analyzed, and so spend money smartly, yes, but money does matter, and right now the kids in Pennsylvania need more investment, particularly in struggling lower-income school districts.
I do want to move on to some other big-ticket items. But to you, Elizabeth, as you said, we need to think more wisely about how this money is invested. If you don't like how it's invested now, how would you improve it?
All right. So there is an education funding formula, a new one that the legislature worked on this year that we think is a good step in the right direction that does a better job of making sure the funding follows the student and that the dollars follow the kids into the classroom rather than being absorbed by administrators or other overhead. Right now, we just think there's too much going to those things and not enough going to the actual classroom, to actual instruction. And so that's one way that we can start to use our dollars more efficiently, making sure that the resources are getting to the areas that desperately need them. And I don't think it's I think it's also imperative that students have the ability to go to the best school for their individual learning styles. And so that's why we're very supportive of programs like the Education Improvement Tax Credit Program that allows businesses to give scholarships to kids so that they can attend schools where they will get the best quality education for their individual learning needs.
But, I mean, it seems to me, shouldn't the goal of any state or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to make sure that all children are going to get a quality education as opposed to children whose parents can be more proactive than others?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, we want to see improvement in our public schools. And we also think that the choice to even move around to different public schools is very important, and that where your child goes to school shouldn't depend on their zip code. It should depend on what's best for that child, whether it's the district school right next door or a charter school of some kind, or, you know, their local public school. We shouldn't restrict kids in that sense, especially in this day and age where there are so many different ways that we can educate kids using the internet, and it just important that all those choices are available to students, and that type of choices are actually shown to save the Commonwealth money at the same time.
And I do want to move on to pensions. Anything you want to add to that, Stephen?
I mean, I can agree with some of what Elizabeth just said. I mean, I'm glad she agrees in the fair funding formula. It's something we can agree on. I totally agree that we should have as much money as possible going to the classroom. You know, when it comes to public school choice, that's certainly something that we think would be, you know, worth an exploration. There's not a proposal, as far as I know, on the mm-hmm. table for that in Pennsylvania at the moment. So right now, the issue is there were these deep cuts in education funding 4 years ago that have had a tangible impact on programs and kids and test scores. We need to reverse those cuts in this budget this year.
And that's Stephen Herzenberg. He's an economist, executive director of the Keystone Research Center. And also with us, Elizabeth Stell, director of policy analysis for the Commonwealth Fund. And we are talking dollars and cents here on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking about the fact that the Commonwealth, in the 65th day of a budget impasse, a budget stalemate, some philosophical disagreements, some fiscal disagreements as well. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to get to some of the emails and tweets, but let's talk very quickly, if we could, about pensions. I know people are rolling their eyes, and how boring can this be? Would you say, Stephen, there's enough blame to go around, and is the state in some kind of pension crisis?
The state has a pension problem. It has a lot of pension debt. I think most of the blame goes to the legislature, you know, in partnership with several governors of both parties. And the legislature took a step forward, deeply cutting pensions for future workers in 2010. It should build on that reform. There are some ways to do that. There are also some signs of possible compromises. Governor Wolf recently made some additional concessions, basically, in terms of what's called a stacked hybrid. So at a certain point, his proposal was $100,000. Over and above that, you would have a 401k-style plan.
Right.
It's actually that's the pension design that he embraced there is actually the pension design that was the second of two Republican proposals that was advanced in the previous legislative session. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily thrilled by some of the concessions he made there. But, I mean, I think there are signs of compromise. What we don't need, and this is back to Governor Wolf doesn't like stupid ideas, doesn't like ideas that are going to cost taxpayers, hurt retirees, and hurt the quality of education and state services. So the kind of pension proposal that he will be dead set against and struggle to accept, even in a grand compromise, will be a proposal like the ones that have been championed this year, Senate Bill 1, that that actually make the problem worse. So I think it really comes down to the Republicans and whether the olive branch that I think he put out to them a few weeks ago on pensions, whether they will pick that up. If they do, that's a path to resolution of the pension issue.
Elizabeth, you have a solution to the pension problem in Pennsylvania?
Well, I would first say that I think we do have a crisis. We have a huge unfunded liability that we're at this point passing on to future generations, which is just morally wrong. And in terms of the solution, how do we tackle this huge problem? You know, first you have to fix the system so that the problem doesn't get larger, and then you have to figure out a way to make good on the promises that were made to our state employees and our teachers. It's very important that we follow through on that. They are not at fault in this situation. But part of the governor's proposal is to simply borrow money to pay off some of the pension debt, which we'll then have to pay later. It's like taking out another credit card when you already have credit card debt. And we just don't think that's wise and, you know, just a terrible idea, and really doesn't help solve the problem. So instead, we need to change the system, moving to what we call a defined contribution plan, similar to a 401k, which basically everyone in the private sector now has, is the way to go, whether it's through some sort of hybrid system where there's some what we call defined benefit in there as well. You know, there will be compromises that will be made there, and that's fine, but we need to start giving the employees a little more say in their retirement, make it a retirement that they're able to take with them if they change jobs, the current system is very backloaded. And so if you have the same job for 30, 35 years, it works very well for the employee. But if you're someone who's only working as a teacher for maybe 10 years and then you change your career, it's not as beneficial. Mm. So moving to a defined contribution system also helps update the retirement system to better serve the different job market that we have today versus how people worked 20, 30 years ago.
Is there some middle ground here, Stephen? And then I'll get some callers in the conversation.
So again, Governor Wolf has put on the table a sort of stacked hybrid. Elizabeth, even though most of the time she was talking about 401k style plans, sort of did in passing open the door. So I'm glad the Commonwealth Foundation is sort of willing to discuss some kind of stacked hybrid. Our view, we're pretty expert on the pension issue. I mean, I am an economist, and we work closely with some of the academic experts on pensions across the country. There's a wealth of research that 401k style plans are not as efficient as pooled defined benefit plans. The 401k style plans have lower returns when people invest their own money, and they have higher costs, higher Wall Street costs. So the bottom line is according to the estimates of the National Institute on Retirement Security, it costs twice as much in contributions, typically, to get the same retirement benefit. So the public sector happens to be able to, if it's smart, able to manage huge pooled, efficient defined benefit pensions like we have now. So research, it's an analytically based, evidence-based position that says, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's manage our existing pensions much better in the future. Again, if we can get to a conversation that's based on efficiency and what really serves taxpayers, retirees, and the quality of public services, we can solve this problem.
Well, and one of the arguments is, of course, well, in the private sector, people have 401ks, and why not make the public sector like the private sector?
Well, so half the people in the private sector don't even have a lousy 401k, and about 75% of the other people have a mostly lousy 401k.
They don't know how to manage it,
because typically neither employers nor employees put enough money into them. So the median amount of money in a 401k style plan is about $20,000. That's not enough to retire on. So if you want to blow up retirement security in America, then we can go down the path that the private sector did. That's a different crisis, a more human crisis that we don't want. It's actually the real crisis. Real retirement crisis is, in fact, the collapse of retirement security in the private sector in this country. So you don't want to go down that failed path.
Let me get Joe from Fox. Hold on, Elizabeth. Joe, I mm-hmm. think, has some comments about the pension, and I'll give you a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Joe. You're on Radio Times. Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First time calling in, but I really enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I like to focus on the local and state issues. I put onto the program around Marcella Shell, but I want to jump to the pension issue. And I couldn't agree more that the state, especially the public employee pension system, has to go to a defined contribution program. And I think it's a bit disingenuous for Steve to say, 401ks are lousy or people don't have them as a reason not to have them. There is a sense of personal responsibility, and it isn't the job of the state government to make sure everybody has a comfortable, cushy retirement. Now, with that being said, we don't want to blow up the retirement system, like he says, and the stability that's there. But, we can't continue to allow our public pension liabilities to skyrocket with that rising interest rates that's coming, and it's draining hundreds of millions of dollars out of our services that could go into schools.
Well, Joe, let me
go into roads and transportation.
Let me take your comment and give Elizabeth a chance to weigh in, and perhaps Stephen, you'd like to do that as well. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to point out very quickly that there also are studies that show that investment returns are just as good in defined contribution plans, and that they don't necessarily cost more to administer. There's a recent study by Manhattan Institute that showed that, and a Deloitte study also shows that 401k plans cost the same or less to administer than traditional defined contribution plans. But to answer Joe's question, or his statement rather, about the retirement security, you know, absolutely, there are things that the state can do to assist employees in making sure that they have a well-funded retirement. You can set up annuities so that folks have a predictable annual payments during their retirement years. There are lots of different things that you can put into a defined contribution plan to help individuals save for their retirement. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it is the individual's responsibility, but the state and as the employer can undertake different provisions to help employees make sure that they have savings for their golden years.
So go ahead, Steve.
So, yeah, frankly, I want to get off the pension issue.
Me too. We're almost up in a break, but no, go ahead. But it's important, but complicated.
I am more tired of the pension issue than anyone in your audience.
It is important.
So it is important. The first thing I want to say is that the Manhattan Institute study that Elizabeth referred to has been debunked by the National Institute on Retirement Security. It's an apples to oranges comparison. They're not looking at public sector defined benefit plans versus public sector defined contribution plans. That's the right comparison in terms of costs and returns. But the second thing is we can agree that the pensions in Pennsylvania have been mismanaged in the past. But the good news is that pension plans like the ones we have, defined benefit pools with low costs and high returns, have been managed well in some other states. Mm-hmm. And what they do is common sense. It starts with, here's a really tough one, you have to put in the right amount of contributions each year. You can't act like the pension is free when you have a downturn or when you want to invest in something else that year. That's how the Pennsylvania legislature and governors behaved over 12 years.
So they used it as a kind of a piggy bank, didn't they?
They did use it as a piggy bank. And so and all along, public sector workers were putting in on average 7 cents of every dollar of every paycheck, never missed a single one. Paying twice as much over like 2001 to 2012 as employers paid, which is the reverse of the ratio in other states in that period where employers typically put in twice as much as employees. So the bottom line is we absolutely do have to manage our pensions going forward much more responsibly so we don't get a repeat of the kind of debt we got to manage now. That's something that we can agree on.
And that's Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. Also with us, Elizabeth Stell, Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Fund. We are talking about finding some common ground on the Pennsylvania budget, now day 65 of the budget impasse, talking about some of the big ticket items, severance tax, pensions, and we'll be talking about liquor sales after this very short break. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. Also get some more callers and comments on the air. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Elizabeth Stell and Stephen Herzenberg about the getting their thoughts, I should say, on the budget impasse in Pennsylvania. If there is room for compromise in creating a spending plan for the state, and calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I see some Facebook comments as well. All right, so we talked about the severance tax, we talked about pensions, and I do want to talk about liquor sales. And from your perspective, and let me actually just quote from the Auditor General, who said recently, on the liquor side of it, all I can tell you is that consumers want more convenience, and there's a way to find a compromise to do that as well. Talking about figuring out what to do about the fact, I guess, that the state is in the liquor sale business. To you, Elizabeth, what do you think should be done about liquor sales in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think we should have privatized the system a long time ago. You know, you look at the polls, people want the convenience and people want the government to get out of the booze business. There's really no reason it should be in it. Some may argue that it's an asset, but when you look at the money that the system is bringing in, most of it is from taxes that would be placed on private stores as well. So you're not going to lose any revenue there. There's corruption. I mean, I think that's the largest part of this issue that's in front of us right now. We just had the news break about a former director of marketing and merchandising at the PLCB, James Short, who's pleading guilty to federal charges of soliciting and concealing bribes and kickbacks, all types of things that happen when you have a government monopoly over a product like liquor. In Pennsylvania, it's shown in surveys, isn't any safer because it has state control over liquor. So it's way past time to get the state out of the liquor business. And, you know, its impact on the budget, you know, that's up in the air. Mm-hmm. We don't know when those revenues would be available and exactly what those revenues would be. So I think we have to be careful about counting our chickens before we hatch there. But budget aside, I think there's just absolutely no reason why Pennsylvania should continue to have a system that 47 other states have disposed of long ago.
And Stephen, it is a vestige of prohibition that we have here in Pennsylvania. Is there a reason, a good reason, to keep it as it is?
So speaking of polls, which Elizabeth mentioned, polls are very clear. Pennsylvanians don't want to talk about liquor, and they don't want to talk about pensions. They want to talk about education and jobs and, to some extent, the severance tax. So the only reason we're talking again for the fifth budget in a row about pensions and liquor privatization, because those are priorities of the Republican majority in the legislature.
You're saying people don't care about it?
It's not what I think. It's what polls show. I mean, it's not a priority issue. It's the top priority of a tiny – those two issues are the top priority of a tiny number of Pennsylvanians. So having said that, again, for the Commonwealth Foundation, this is a pure philosophical / ideological issue. They don't think the government should be in this business. When you look actually at the economics, Elizabeth asserted that we wouldn't lose any revenue. That's based on nothing that I've seen from them. The definitive study on this has been done by Roland Zulo, who's a research scientist at the University of Michigan, and he looked at all the states, including the ones with the most control and the most privatized, and the states that have liquor control like we have get more revenue from this industry. It's not that much of a surprise. So in the end, when you look at the facts, there's a real danger of losing revenue, and we can't afford to do that. It also happens to be true that a national task force of public health professionals that's staffed in part by the Center for Disease Control recommended several years ago that there be no further privatization of retail control in states of liquor privatization for public health reasons, because in a series of episodes in Canada and European countries, when they privatized, they found in those natural experiments that consumption and consumption by people who drink too much went up, and that in turn is associated with public health problems, with traffic fatalities on the highways. So again, from a pure public policy point of view, in terms of money and in terms of health and safety, liquor privatization doesn't make sense. But the biggest reason that I think Governor Wolf will hesitate goes back to the money issue, and he absolutely is not going to be happy doing a fire sale privatization that that gets a song for tremendous asset that the state owns and digs a deeper hole in terms of our structural deficit down the road.
But why does it have to be a fire sale? I mean, why can't it? Why?
Well, if you do it quickly in the context of a budget, and again, it's hard to – the research shows that it's hard to do privatization in a way that doesn't end up losing money. Now, if you do it quickly and poorly, you'll lose more money. Washington State lost money a few years ago on its privatization of its liquor system. So, again, for us, this is not an ideological issue. It's a pragmatic issue, let's shift the focus. We didn't do this last year. We didn't do it the year before. We would certainly agree with modernization, as Governor Wolf would. But can we please get to the issues that are priorities for Pennsylvanians?
Well, let's get to some callers. We have Ann from Conshohocken joining us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
great
there.
Show. Thanks, Stephen and Elizabeth.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the point that, you know, I would like to live in a state where the budget begins with the framing question of what do families need to thrive, right? And not what does the liquor industry need to make more money, because that's really what liquor privatization is about. It's that the liquor industry is tired of selling wholesale to, you know, Pennsylvania. They would much rather make more money and sell retail. And, you know, as the mom of teenagers, I know I grew up in New Jersey. It was very easy for me to walk in as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, and get served. It's not easy in Pennsylvania to do that. And for, you know, just to shore up the health and safety point, as a mom of teenagers, I would much rather have the liquor stores under tighter control. One last thing is that, you know, there's an effort. There actually is something that people care about, and that's high quality preschool. There's a campaign going on. Like, people are writing letters. They want to see high quality, affordable preschool for more families. They don't care about liquor privatization. They don't care about liquor stores. They care about, like, who's taking care of their kids when they go to work.
Well, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss that to you, Elizabeth. An argument from a caller who says the system is working as it is.
Well, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate her concern about making sure that our kids are not served when they're minors. But I think we have to be realistic that, you know, for people in the Philadelphia area, New Jersey is not far away. It's not hard to go to places where there is less state control. And there's no reason why Pennsylvania should get out of the enforcement business in terms of enforcing the liquor laws that we have in place. Right now, the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board has a very hypocritical mission. They're on one hand supposed to increase sales of alcohol, and on the other hand supposed to police and restrict the use of alcohol. And I don't think you can do either very well when you have such a conflicting mission. So let's have the state focus on enforcement, focus on keeping us safe, rather than focus on selling alcohol and increasing sales.
Let me read an email that we got from someone talking about his wife, who he describes as the breadwinner of our family. While this dad cares for their one-year-old son, she works at a nonprofit in Philadelphia providing essential services. And this nonprofit relies on state funding to provide these services. The stalemate in passing the budget has forced my wife's employer to succumb to layoffs and salary reductions. I mean, at some point, Stephen, there's going to have to be some kind of compromise here. As you said, you know, the governor doesn't like dumb ideas. You know, I'm not sure what his definition of all these potential dumb ideas are, but at some point, there's going to have to be some middle ground.
There is, and I'm glad we're off wine and spirits.
I want
first to go back to the previous caller who talked about pre-kindergarten. By the way, the Republican budget that Governor Wolf vetoed had only a quarter as much money, as much of an increase in pre-kindergarten. So it is, in the end, it's a question of values. And when you look at his proposals, including, for example, the minimum wage that he wanted to pass in conjunction with the budget, is the values are educational opportunity. For all, economic opportunity, such as the higher minimum wage, strong communities, his property tax proposal, growth. I mean, again, he's trying to reinvest in jobs and education, and that in turn will strengthen the recovery. And actually, his values as expressed recently by the state implementing online registration is he believes in democracy, not in voter ID that suppresses voting. So again, the values of the governor as expressed on his budget are on target. Now, when it comes to compromise, listen, he's a practical problem-solving man. He's ready to compromise. The process so far, it's early March, governor's budget. June 30th, veto, with the Republicans not even having come an inch. Then you go the summer, and most of the Republicans are home on vacation. The Wolf administration's working hard, ready to meet with anybody, anytime. So it's really the onus is on the Republicans, and the onus, frankly, is on the Republican leaders in the Senate in this region. They have to decide, in the Philadelphia suburbs, they have to decide, are they going to attach themselves, really for the first time, to an ideological agenda that leads to a budget stalemate that lasts all year, then causes a lot of heartache in schools and human service providers? Or are they going to do what they've often done in the past, which is be the voice of reason and for compromise?
Are you talking about moderate Republicans?
I'm talking about the moderate Republicans in the Philadelphia suburbs. And so on severance tax, on school funding, where they've already acknowledged that the $400 million That the governor proposed is a legitimate number. On property tax, where he put together a proposal that was adapted from Republican proposals. It's somewhat different, but in ways that from our point of view make perfect sense from a values point of view. So the onus really is on the Republican Party to, for the first time, begin to have a substantive conversation. That's how we can get a budget that benefits all Pennsylvanians. And frankly, this matters for the next 4 years. Because if they can get through this difficult process and let the people's priorities and problem solving and pragmatism rise above ideology, then we can have a great 4 years.
Do you see it that way, Elizabeth?
You know, I think first it's important to point out that it takes two to have a budget stalemate. It's on both the governor and the legislature to get down and work on this and figure out a compromise. And I would also point out that it was the governor that vetoed the entire budget at the end of June. He could have line item vetoed and let some line items go through and funding flow to those areas where there was agreement. And he refused to do that. He did an entire veto of the budget, and that's something that we haven't seen in a long time in Pennsylvania. So it takes two to have a stalemate. And in terms of how do we grow the economy, you know, right now we're really in a situation where we're putting people in a hostage situation for tax hikes. The governor is asking for the largest tax hikes in Pennsylvania history. This should not be taken lightly. It's really extreme when you look at the budget and tax increases that have been proposed in every other state in the nation this year. And so it is going to take time to work out. But again, I think there is a lot of common sense behind doing some sort of stopgap measure now to make sure that we don't continue to make others suffer for this situation. And I'd also want to point out very quickly that the property tax is changes or differences between the Republican proposal and the governor's proposal are very different. The Republican proposal would offer $1 billion more in property tax relief, and the governor's proposal is asking for $3.5 billion more in taxes. Mm. That's a dramatic difference. So again, largest tax hike in history, this is in many ways a very extreme proposal, and so it's no wonder that it's taken so long for Republicans and the governor to negotiate and find a compromise.
Largest tax hike in Pennsylvania history, Stephen?
It might be in nominal dollar terms, but the fact is that most of the revenue raised in the Wolf property tax proposal is based on, first of all, an income tax increase that's identical to a Republican bill that passed the House in May. And then he has a sales tax broadening and increase to 6.6%, whereas the Republican House bill that passed in May doesn't have a broadening but does have an increase to 7%. So basically, he really did adapt his revenue proposals. They're not the same, but he adapted them fairly closely from Republican proposals. Elizabeth's right that Wolf's proposal is not dollar for dollar property mm-hmm. tax reduction. Mm-hmm. That's because we have a structural deficit and a need to invest in education. So, but most of the money, sort of $3.5 billion or so out of $4.5 billion, most of the money raised does go to property tax relief. So again, that's absolutely an area for compromise. Education funding, both sides have agreed we need $400 million. It's an area for compromise. We talked in passing about the pension concessions that Governor Wolf made recently. We may hold our nose at some of those and argue why they're we shouldn't go further in the direction he's talking about. But that's a basis for compromise. So again, it's time to get back to Harrisburg, get down to work, and we can get this done. A severance tax, at times in the past few years, moderate Republicans have supported a severance tax increase. So there's a basis for a compromise here that includes, and one last point I'll make.
Very quickly.
Okay. Well, the other thing is Governor Wolf's proposed to cut the corporate net income tax in half, which has been a Republican priority forever. We have this enormous high corporate net income tax. So he absolutely has tried to reach into their idea kit, and now it's time for them to reciprocate and get a deal done.
Elizabeth, we are out of time, but I've seen several proposals lock all these people in a room together over the weekend, and they'll come up with something. Do you agree with that quickly?
It's possible, but I would just say if people want to learn more about the specific budget issues, they can go to our website, commonwealthfoundation.org, and see our proposals for solving the budget stalemate.
And people can go to www.pennbpc.org. That's the website of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, which is the tax and budget project of the Keystone Research Center. Thank you, Marty.
And thank you both for joining us today in Radio Times. We'll post those addresses on our website so you can check them out. Elizabeth, Stell, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Stephen Herzenberg, thank you for joining us as well.
It's been a pleasure.
And go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.